Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush Friday. I guess what is now a filmmaker series with Cole Stratton. Cole, what did you just drink? What was that?
Let's see. Unsweetened Pure Leaf iced tea. Okay. It looks like Jack Daniels. Like,
it totally does.
It really does. It's a big square
black bottle. That was
drinking a handle in the morning.
So, yeah, Cole is back, which I'm very excited about to have you in the regular rotation. And we email back and forth about just some different ideas for some kind of 4 to 5 episode series. And you threw out some filmmakers, you threw out sports movies, you threw out a bunch of cool ideas, and we zeroed in on John Frankenheimer.
Yeah, oddly, my favorite director. It's weird. Like, the stuff that is my favorite are the things that people would never, ever associate me with. Like, political thrillers and action movies.
And Searching for Bobby Fischer.
Right, exactly. It's like, you work in comedy, right? Yep. But for some reason, Frankenheimer was a huge deal to me working at the video stores and coming through film school and stuff like that. I just loved him. So I tend to gravitate towards his movies.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit and talk about the man first. Because when you first threw that out, I was like, oh, yeah, totally Frankenheimer. And then I was looking over his list of films and it's like, I think I just had him confused in my head with other people. Maybe McTiernan. I don't know why, but when I saw the film list, there was a bunch of them I hadn't seen.
Yeah, he worked a lot. I mean, he came out of live TV dramas, like Playhouse 90 and things like that. He was an assistant director to Sidney Lumet back then, which is hilarious because those two are two of my favorite directors. So, he's kept making stuff. And there's a lot of stinkers in there too, but there's a lot of great things as well.
What's name a stinker?
Oh boy. Island of Dr. Moreau.
Is that him?
But he says he was brought into that. He says it was the worst thing ever. He and Val Kilmer did not get along. He famously said Will Rogers never met Val Kilmer. Cause he's met so it was just like a shit show.
Yeah. I don't think that can be laid at his feet. I mean, that was just a notorious, terrible production.
Yeah. And Reindeer Games was one of his last movies. And that's,
not any good.
It's not very good. It's kind of a historically bad flop of a movie. And there's others mixed in too, but he's just made a lot of really great action movies and political thrillers.
Yeah. I mean, he's known for the political thriller, which is one of my favorite genres as well. And he kind of came up during the sort of peak of the Cold War was when he first got going, which, do you know much about the guy and like why this genre appealed to him so much?
I mean, I definitely know a bit about him. I don't really know exactly why he ended up doing that. He came to prominence in the late 50s, early 60s. So the atmosphere in the country and in the world in general was very politically charged. Mm-hmm. The movie we're going to talk about came out in 62 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think he just always kind of gravitated towards that. And he also was like a guy that a lot of actors like Sinatra, Burt Lancaster, people like that would just bring in because, I mean, Lancaster said like, he's a bit of a whore, but he'll do what I want basically about him. So yeah, like I don't know why he gravitated towards it, but he definitely made a mark in it.
Yeah. Well, first up, I think we've settled on the four, which was, I just kind of gave you carte blanche there because he's your guy. And I think I've only seen of those four films, Ronin, and I only saw that once.
Yeah, that Ronin was definitely a return to form for me. I remember seeing that and just being like blown away. Like, that's weird too. It's like, I'm not into cars. I'm not into car racing. My whole thing with a car is like, does it have a good stereo and air conditioning? I'm good.
Right.
like, that's all I need. But for some reason, like his car chases, like he's one of the best at that. And Ronin and then Grand Prix and a bunch of other stuff mm-hmm. too. Like he's really good at lensing action in a way that's exciting, but also you can see what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
which is huge to me because so many action movies nowadays are like, they cut so fast. You can't tell what's going on. I'm like, I don't know who to root for. I mean, totally. That was my biggest problem with, I think it was Quantum of Solace. There's that like chase scene at the beginning where they're jumping on top of like the awnings and stuff like that too. And Bond yeah. and the other guy are wearing clothing that's roughly the same. And I'm like, I don't know if I should be rooting for him to catch him right now, or if he's like, I don't understand when they're in the car. Like it's, so that's a huge thing for me. I like to be able to track the action and have it feel more realistic, which I think Frankenheimer did a really good job with.
Yeah, that's become a trend, a negative trend, I think, in filmmaking is unfollowable action sequences. It's really annoying.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's more thrilling when a camera just sits there in his back and you actually see what the hell's going on, or it feels more raw and real. Like that's more exciting to me than something that's so sensationalized that it's beyond belief. I mean, obviously there's things to say about things like Fast and the Furious or whatever like that, that are over the top on purpose and it's completely ridiculous. But yeah, I find the action more exciting when you can follow it and it feels a little more like it's really happening.
Well, and a couple of trends I think made it tougher to follow, which was, I mean, I guess handheld isn't a trend, but it's always been around, but using handheld for action and then couple that with the weird frame rate thing that kind of came in vogue. Those two things combined just make it really tough, I think.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I like Paul Greengrass as a director, but his stuff is like, you got to sit in the back of the theater and take a Dramamine pill because it's so handheld to the point of just being like, you know, I get it, but you don't have to handhold every shot of everything. I need to get my bearings. Yeah. You know, I'm not on a boat. So
right. And you can still sort of give that energy or dictate that energy to the audience without making everything so herky-jerky.
Yeah, exactly.
So we are starting off with The Manchurian Candidate from 1962, a movie that I, again, got wrong in my head. I think I get this mixed up in my brain with 3 Days of the Condor, and I expected, I guess, color and something a little more contemporary, and then when that beautiful black and white came on the screen, I had to adjust my backlighting on the television very quickly because I try and match it a little bit. Oh, here comes my daughter. You want to come say hi? Did she come in last time?
I think she did briefly, yeah. It's like the, it's like the Hitchcock cameo.
You want to say hi to Cole?
Hi, Cole.
Hey there. Good to see you.
How you doing?
Good.
All right. This is going to be a brief cameo, Mr. Hitchcock. I know I gave you permission to come down here occasionally, but can you just say hi and bye? All right. Come on. Out with you. Out with you. I got to continue, please. I know. I'm sorry. I know that hurts your feelings. Feelings are made to be hurt. Are you going to sit there? Huh? All right, hold on. Let me officially break here.
All right.
Okay, so I'm sure this is some kind of awkward transition because that actually took more work than usual to get her out of here. So sorry about that. So yeah, Manchurian Candidate. I changed the movie background, my backlighting on my TV kind of to hopefully sort of enhance the movie. And boy, that black and white with this, that really bright white backlight just looks so good.
It looks great.
I think I sent you a screenshot even.
He kept working in black and white until 66. That's when his last one was. Seconds was his last one he did in black and white. And then for Grand Prix, he went in color and never went back. But he definitely worked in black and white a lot longer than a lot of other filmmakers did at the time.
Yeah, that's a cool decision. I'm a big fan of black and white. And it just looks so good on a good TV. Frank Sinatra. Getting to see him, you know, I haven't seen him in a ton of movies. I think I saw Ocean's 11 and I haven't seen enough movies from this era, but Sinatra is he just has a presence, doesn't he?
He does. He's a movie star, but he's actually a good actor too. I think that's what people miss out on is, you know, he's got the persona of a, you know, he was a giant star in every medium at the time too.
Yeah.
And connected. And all of that stuff too. But he's actually a really, really fine actor. And I think this is the best thing he's ever done. And I think he believed that as well.
Yeah, he's on record as kind of saying this is the best acting he's done. And I know that, I'm sure you know this story, but he kind of oddly bought the rights to this film and kind of kept it under lock and key for many years. Isn't that right?
Yeah, he shut it down because it came out, like, John F. Kennedy was a big fan of, like, he helped get the movie made. United Artists didn't really want to make it. Because it's very, you know, it's, I don't know what the audience is for this. It's very politically charged. It's, you know, obviously it's fairly liberal in its leanings, I guess you'd say. But Sinatra's a big fan of it. He took it to UA. They weren't really crazy about it. And he got JFK to call UA there to say, I want to do this. Who's going to play the mother, whatever. And because the president endorsed it, UA went ahead and made it.
Who are you going to cast as the mother? That's my bad Kennedy.
She better be a wicked good actor.
You just have to start every sentence with
right.
So who's the other actor? Who's the guy who plays the lead?
Lawrence Harvey.
Right. And did you know the little tidbit about his daughter in real life?
I did not.
So good. I'm glad I can surprise you with something on this. His daughter in real life was Domino Harvey, the bounty hunter on whom the movie Domino was based.
Right, that flop follow-up by Richard Kelly. I never saw it,
Was that one of his movies?
What's that?
Was that a Richard Kelly movie?
I think it was. I think it's what he did after, like, Donnie Darko or something. I could be totally wrong on this, but I'd have to look it up.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I knew it wasn't supposed to be a very good movie. But yeah, his daughter in real life was a bounty hunter, and she very sadly suffered from addiction and died, I think overdosed and died from using drugs. But yeah, this guy is someone I haven't seen a lot either, but he's got a somewhat stiff but big screen presence as well, I think.
Yeah. By the way, I just looked it up. Richard Kelly wrote Domino. Tony Scott directed it.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
So there you go. Sort of right. Yeah, Lawrence Harvey is actually a really good actor. I think that was part of this character was to be like, there's this whole sequence in it where he talks when he gets drunk and he talks about how lovable he was at this one time in this relationship. But his character is so completely unlikable and unlovable and like, you know, hates his mom, hates his situation. And, you know, that's the whole thing about the brainwashing and stuff, too, is all of his troop mates and stuff are programmed to say this thing about him, which is you could never be true because he's so the opposite of that.
Yeah. And to be fair, he hates his mom for a good reason. The great Angela Lansbury, to see her in this kind of role is really pretty fantastic. If you are surprised by this movie like I was, never seen her go dark like this, and boy, she was good.
Yeah, it's to me it's my favorite villain performance in any movie because it's so you don't know that first and foremost. I don't think I'm spoiling anything. You've had 60 years to watch this movie before whatever. But you know, the fact that like she's so good and so cool and controlling in this whole thing, and she wasn't the first choice. Frank Sinatra wanted Lucille Ball to play the role.
Oh, wow.
And so Frankenheimer had to fight for her to do it because she had done a movie with Frankenheimer right before this called All Fall Down with Warren Beatty and Eva Marie Saint and Carl Malden. It's a really, really good movie, too. And Angela Lansbury was in that. So he was like, I think she's right for this, and convinced them all to do it. And thank God, because she was nominated for an Oscar for it. It's such a good performance.
Yeah, she's fantastic. And you're right in that you don't sort of get the big reveal until the end that she is actually sort of the American, what do you call her? Like a sleeper agent?
Pretty much sleeper agent.
So you don't really learn that, but previous to that moment, she's still awful. And she's still this sort of behind the scenes puppeteer for her husband, who was played by James Gregory. He was fantastic as well.
So good. Such a good blowhard.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting to see this movie and the politics of it. Just sort of, I imagine there are various points in history there where this movie was pretty relevant.
Yeah, and it's weird that so many years later that it feels, especially now in the last couple of years, like so many parallels to what's been going on in our country that, you know, I'm not a political person, really. I tend to, like, I have anxiety issues, and that just, like, really puts me on edge even more. So I try to, like, disassociate myself with it as much as I can.
Yeah.
But there's so many parallels to this, of the Soviets having a hand in our election process. And
yeah,
all, it's just so creepy. And the fact that, like, the main candidate, James Gregory's character, Eisland, is just such a, like, it has absolutely no, he's a tool. Like, he's completely vapid and stupid and dumb and being manipulated by everyone around him.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels, yeah, it's just creepy as hell to me. Honest.
It is. And he is a total tool in the sense of, as a, of an implement, not like a frat boy. but he's so easily manipulated, but still is so comfortable getting in front of a microphone and just parroting whatever he's being told. It's almost like he is brainwashed as well at times.
Right. I mean, honestly, like, he is the Manchurian candidate, really. Like, that is who he is. So in a sense that, like, he's the one that they're trying to get put into the White House and all that stuff too. And
yeah,
because of all the brainwashing. So, and I think that there's not a lot of humor in this movie, but there's some in choice spots. And he has one of my favorite things, which is he's constantly waffling on the number of communists in the party, throwing numbers out, and he gets really upset. And he finally says to Angela Lansbury, to Eleanor, like, come on, can we just settle on a number? And he's hitting ketchup out of a bottle. And of course, the next scene cuts straight to, there are 57 communists. Like, 57. It's so good.
It is. And that's sort of a funny, I mean, this movie is a satire in some ways too, or at least it dabbles in there. Like, I don't think you can look at a joke like the Heinz 57 joke without it clearly being satire of how just, I don't know, how easily politics can be perverted.
Totally. And that's still relevant today. We still have ketchup. So, you know,
yeah,
he was a visionary.
It's funny, right when they honed in on that bottle, I was like, oh yeah, it's going to be 57 for sure.
Nope.
And this was like smash cut, 57 communists.
So good. And then that scene just kind of fades out in a cacophony. It's literally just like,
yeah,
here's the punchline. Let's move on.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, and we'll get into, you know, we'll jump all over the place as usual and talk about more of the acting roles, but I want to talk a little bit about the look of the movie. Aside from the beautiful black and white, you've got some really just top quality filmmaking going on with the use of deep focus, sort of a la Citizen Kane. They do that great deep focus shot a couple of times, which is one of my favorite things that you don't see a lot anymore.
Oh yeah, fully. I mean, the shots are very carefully composed. You can tell. There's some brilliant ones too. There's like the other senator, like the kind of hero senator in a sense, when he's talking to Lawrence Harvey in a flashback in the kitchen, there's these wings behind him. It's like an eagle thing, but it's framed in a way that looks like he's an angel.
It's cool.
It's like such a cool thing. And then later on, there's a similar shot, but Lawrence Harvey's way underneath the wings, or like it's above him, like it's looking over him. Yes, it was actually nominated. It was nominated for two Oscars, for Angela Lansbury and also for editing, which is super great too.
Yeah. Yeah. I could totally see that. The other great standout visual sequence for me was when, in the press conference, when the senator is sort of making that first accusation and Angela Lansbury sort of in the wings in the crowd of the people, and the way it's shot, it's what you're seeing on these television monitors is playing out in real time right behind them. And like, I don't know that I've ever seen anything quite like that.
To me, that, like, I feel like that came out of his live TV background in a sense.
Oh,
that
yeah.
They basically like would shoot plays live. That's kind of what that was back then, Playhouse 90 or whatever. So in a sense, that's what he would be looking at. He would be seeing the actors do this play and then he's looking at his monitor or whatever. So I think it probably just kind of came out of that as an idea for the shot. And yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite sequences of the movie. And just the controlled chaos of that room. I mean, it's not like hundreds of people, but there's the way they make movies these days is just, I feel like you don't get a lot of great stuff like this, where you pack a room with, you know, 100 people and just let this sort of chaos be what it is and just capture it all on film. It really works.
Yeah. And honestly, like to me, the best shot sequence in the whole thing is the brainwashing sequence when the camera just keeps like revolving and rotating and going back and forth from the old ladies giving the hydrangea lecture while they wait out a storm, which George Axelrod took that dialogue from an actual transcript of like a Seed meeting or something.
Oh, really?
And then it keeps rotating back and forth between like the communist leaders and stuff and what it really is happening and the dialogue switching back and forth. Like, it's really amazing. And Sinatra at the time, like, he was kind of, you know, very much in control of things in a lot of ways. And he like wanted to see see what it was going to look like at the end before he left. So they really quickly edited together what it was going to look like. And that's actually what they ended up using.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was known as one take Sinatra.
Of course he was.
He really was. Like, he wanted to just get it done and get out. Like, he didn't do multiple takes that often unless they really needed. Yeah. Almost everything is that he's in is a first take scene. Almost everything.
Wow. That's cool to know. And that doesn't surprise me either. Frank seems like the kind of guy that doesn't suffer the frivolities of a film set.
Nope. I mean, I wish there was more like it. You know what I mean? Keep it moving. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's how Eastwood shoots. Like, that's why he does totally a million movies and puts out one a year. Is like, he sets it up, he does one or two takes, he moves on.
Yeah, I've heard some stories about Eastwood sets and just how great they are. No yelling, no like. I think they have very specific walkie-talkie rules, which sounds silly, but if you've ever been on a film set, just the hysteria that goes on with the walkie-talkies,
yeah,
can create this anxiety that he just doesn't want around,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And Clint can call the shots like that.
Super cool. Yeah, but Frank definitely was like in charge of all that kind of stuff and moving stuff forward. And he actually got hurt on this film in a way that like his pinky is bent, which if you see him in later interviews for the rest of his life from the karate fight sequence.
Which is great.
Which is so ridiculous. But when he breaks the board with his hand, it like broke his finger.
Oh, wow.
But they didn't have time to like let it heal properly or whatever and put it in a splint or whatever, because they just needed to shoot the rest of the movie out, because they shot in like 30 something days or whatever. So it just never healed correctly. So he's kind of, it hurt him for the rest of his life. And, you know, you could see like he puts a ring on it or whatever to kind of draw attention away from it.
Yeah, that sequence is pretty fun. It's borderline Clouseau and Kato.
It really
going
is.
At it.
Evidently, it was the first like karate scene in a major movie, because it was before whole like kung fu crazy stuff of the 70s happened and stuff, late 60s. So it's so ridiculous. It's cool, but it's also ridiculous. You get why Henry Silva's character would do it, but like, why the hell would Sinatra be doing karate as well?
Yeah, and we should go ahead and mention here, it is not lost on us that this is a time in Hollywood where they cast people of different races to play the wrong race. And I don't think there a true Asian actor in the movie?
I think the guy that played the doctor, Yen Lo. But other than that, I don't know. Like, Henry Silva is like Sicilian and Spanish.
Right.
So
Chinese.
That doesn't really match.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, 1962. So not
exactly. Let's go back to that sequence, though. The brainwashing sequence. If you're listening and you haven't seen this movie, it is a sequence where we first sort of see the group, the squad of soldiers being brainwashed, or having been brainwashed. And this is sort of an exhibition of like, look what we've done with these men. But the way they do it is, in their minds, in the soldiers' minds, they're at a garden club meeting, getting, like you said, this lecture on fun with hydrangeas. And if you've never seen this movie before, it's very jarring, because they don't let you know what's going on. It just sort of cuts back and forth between these two things, and you're left to figure it out, which I think is the exact right way to do it. But it adds a really kind of strange surrealist bent to it, I think.
Oh, fully. Yeah. I mean, they're brainwashed to think that they're just waiting out a storm. That's why they're there. They're having to like sit there, and they're all bored to tears by this. And then it's dark as hell, that scene. I mean, the fact that they basically, the other communists, people demand that they demonstrate that Lawrence Harvey is indeed a tool that they can use to carry out violence. and just, you know, he kills two of his troop mates, that's not even the right word, people from the same, from the military group of his, in weird ways. It's just, I don't know, it's really dark.
Yeah, we're clearly two peacenik liberals that can't even come up with the word squad.
Battalion, platoon, squad, whatever. Yeah.
Battalion, there you go, that's probably what it is.
Yeah.
You know, the group of guys who go in and soldier fight. Do all that stuff.
The G.I. Joe men.
Yeah, exactly. You've also got some cool, the way they sort of bring the story to the audience is not on the nose. Like I said, you're kind of left to figure that part out. You're left to figure out these recurring dreams, that keep happening with Frank Sinatra's character. And, who's the other guy? Al Melvin.
Yeah.
His character, or that's the character's name. So you don't really know what's going on. You're kind of piecing it together. And I like how I felt confused at times, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think the idea was that the audience will be as disoriented as, you know, as Lawrence Harvey is, as Sinatra is, trying to like figure things out as it goes along. And I think they do a good job of explaining it eventually, but not having like, you know, somebody monologue like a Bond villain or something.
Yeah.
I think it plays out in a good way.
No, I think you're right, because I think it's revealed sort of at the end of Act One, or I guess that's the first plot point, is that it's not a shared dream, and that he really did kill these two soldiers. He doesn't realize it yet, but he has really killed these guys in real life.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what's like scary about the whole thing, is like he's meant to carry out these awful acts and doesn't know that he's done them, doesn't remember them. I mean, there's, you know, in Act Three, a thing where he, you know, ends up having to kill his new wife and the other senator and stuff. And, you know, he doesn't know he's doing it, but you can sort of see that he sort of knows in a weird way, because he's walking out and there's tears streaming down his face.
Yeah, I noticed that.
So subconsciously he knows in some way, but he just does, his brain can't put it together, at least at that point.
Yeah, and that's a pretty shocking scene, because you've got this great guy, this liberal senator, who has kind of stated very plainly to Angela Lansbury that he will block the nomination. And I guess this was back when you were nominated for vice president and not just chosen as a running mate. Is that the deal?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so block this nomination. And so, you know, she elects to have him taken out, and I may be wrong, but is this the first shoot someone through the milk container scene in movie history?
It might be. Yeah. It's such a cool shot too.
It is great.
And
shocking too.
Yeah, totally. And in that scene too, like the one you're talking about where Angela Lansbury asks if he'll block the nomination, and he takes a minute, and I actually wrote it down what he says, because it's really apt to where we are now, is if he were a paid Soviet agent, he wouldn't do more damage to the nation than he already has.
Yeah.
So, man, like, it's just that kind of thing of, it's like, oh my God, like, you know, say what your politics are or whatever, whether you believe what's going on or whether, you know, you don't, in terms of Trump and all that kind of stuff too. Just the seeds of this, the idea of these things, the parallels, it's just like, so like, wow, like how, it's so weird that it would be that parallel nowadays.
Yeah, what's the other quote? I thought I had it written down, but the one chilling one from Lansbury at the end, do you have that one written down? Because I can look it up if not.
I didn't write it down, but yeah, the basic idea of like, I didn't know it'd be you, and I'm going to get them back. I don't remember the exact term, quote.
All right, so I can't find the quote, but it's basically sort of invokes the political rallies that we see these days. And it was fairly chilling. But just one of many chilling lines that she has in this movie. I think AFI rated her a top 25 all-time cinema villain.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, the last big scene she has, when she is with Lawrence Harvey privately, and is kind of this is the most monologuing of a villain thing that there is in the movie. But she just sort of explains to him that, like, I didn't know it was going to be you, and they'll pay for this. I wanted an assassin, this whole thing. But then it zooms in and she kisses him on the lips, but does it in a way that, like, and Sinatra kind of talked to her about doing this so it wouldn't have any problems with the censor board at the time. They kind of cup her hands around her mouth to sort of hide it. So you know what's going on, but you don't explicitly see it. And I guess in the book, the Richard Conte's novel, it's very explicitly stated that they're having a relationship. They're in bed together, this whole thing. But you don't really see it in the movie at all. Like, it's sort of kind of out of left field at this point when she, like, you know, literally kisses him, makes out with him for a second. And you're just like, whoa, mom. Like, that's kind of stirring on top of everything else.
No, for sure. I mean, she's this evil, evil, manipulative character. And she has, she's a sleeper agent for the communist. And then she finds out her son is the assassin, doesn't stop it because it feels like she probably could put the brakes on that, even though they obviously used him very much purposefully because he was her son. But when she plants that kiss on him, just I didn't know what to think. I did not see that coming.
Yeah, it's kind of out of nowhere in a sense because they don't really hint at it at all. In fact, it's kind of hinted that they just really dislike each other. I mean, especially he dislikes her.
Yeah.
And she's just always kind of scolding him or whatever. So it's really kind of comes out of nowhere in a sense, but maybe explains a lot too. I don't know.
Oh man, she was fantastic. Big time creeps. Anytime you see the mom kiss a son like that, it's slightly disturbing.
And also at the time too, like she wasn't really, didn't have the persona that she had later in a sense. She's just kind of an actor then. You know, now it's like, oh my God, why is Mrs. Potts kissing her son? Why is she so evil? You know, Murder, She Wrote. Like, you know, she's the wholesome old, the mother, the wholesome lady. And now she's like so messed up in this movie. It's amazing.
Yeah. I love it when an actor, especially back then, sort of in the earlier days, plays this much against type.
Totally.
Kind of a brave choice. Janet Leigh's character, we had someone on the Movie Crush page ask, what was the point of her character, and this, the listener, she just didn't get it. And I'm not fully sure I do either. Let's talk about her for a minute and her purpose.
I know that she struggled with the role because she felt that like she didn't really know what her purpose was either. She didn't really know how to play but she trusted Frankenheimer and Sinatra and stuff like that too. And they kind of chatted through it and stuff. I think she was just kind of there as a support mechanism for Sinatra, who's losing his mind, to be honest. Because I don't think he could have done everything that he did in that movie without someone to kind of bounce ideas off of and just kind of support him in this and let him know that he's not crazy. I think literally that's just what her part was. And they gave her some fun dialogue and like some interesting things to do. But ultimately, like, it's not a role that was, if you had to cut a role, you could cut this. But also I could see why she's in it. I mean, Janet Leigh, this is, you know, at the height of her popularity and stuff too. And I'm sure that helped sell the movie and things.
She's on the poster.
Yep. Which is what's funny about it is it's the three of them above the fold. And then the first one is co-starring Angela Lansbury, which is, I was like, I put all four of them above the fold there. I'm sure.
Oh, totally.
Wasn't a contract thing, but
she owned this. that first scene with Janet Leigh, though, when she and Sinatra first meet each other on the train is really great. And the way the dialogue is written, it's also sort of confusing as to what's going on. And I've got to think that was purposeful.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I think he's so disoriented and so like at the end of his rope at that point, and he doesn't know what to think because he feels that like his brain is telling him one thing, that like he adores Raymond Shaw. But it's also, he also knows that he doesn't, and he doesn't know why that is. And he's trying to figure all of that out. And I think at that point, she's just kind of a respite for like in between things. It's kind of a break for him. And I think that kind of helps him pump the brakes on everything and just take a breath in a sense.
Yeah.
And she doesn't really ask a lot of him. She's just kind of there to kind of bounce things around with. And she does have a pretty funny, like, joke about like the railway, and I'm not in the, if you're in the railway business, you say you're in the railroad line or whatever. Just kind of a throwaway little fun bit there. So she has some pretty good like kind of repartee with him and stuff too. So I don't think she's totally a thankless character, but I don't think it's the most developed thing and the most necessary to the plot mechanics of the film.
Yeah, it sort of reminded me a little bit of the Pulp Fiction of Bruce Willis and his wife, how he was out kind of suffering through these big events, and he would pop back in on her, and she was just sort of this sort of calming, stable force who didn't fully understand what was going on the whole time.
Right. Which is sort of one of the things I did appreciate it for, though, in a sense, is that there aren't scenes of her going like, this is nuts. You got to stop this. What's wrong with you? Like, that's not there at all. Like, she literally is just understanding and is just trying to figure out what's going on with them or whatever. Versus like the thing at the time, which a lot of things would be like, oh, the wife is yelling at me again or whatever.
Right.
It completely avoids that, which I appreciate.
Yeah, totally. And the other female lead in this, and this movie is interesting because it has, you know, for 1962, it has three pretty prominent female characters in the film. One is the villain, which is sort of a bit of a switcheroo. And then you've got Janet Leigh, and then you've got Jocelyn, played by Leslie Parrish, as, you know, who you learn about in flashbacks was had this sort of torrid summer fling with Raymond. And then she comes back again later very prominently as well.
Yeah, it's sort of like the flashback sequences. It's sort of shades of From Here to Eternity. They're like wearing swimsuits in the summer and playing in the banks and lying in the grass and this whole thing. And it's that sequence, I think, is really great because it's the only, it's the first time and the only real time that you see his that he does have a personality.
Yeah.
That he does have a heart and he does have redeeming qualities and stuff like that, too. But the one time he tries to act on it, the one time he finally falls in love and starts to break out of his shell, it's completely squashed by his mom. That he can't stand up to her and ends up writing a letter. And then, you know, so like you'd think that that would be like the only time you'd see her and then that would be over. But then it becomes a plot mechanic and, you know, her reintroduction is huge, especially the fact that she's wearing the Queen of Diamonds costume.
Right.
Which, if anything, that's if there's a fourth female character in the movie, it's the Queen of Diamonds.
Yeah.
Because it's such a huge, it's the trigger mechanism. And then it makes you think, too, when she does show up at the party wearing that, because there's so much going on, you're like, oh, is she in it on it, too? Is she part of the handling? Like, because she's wearing that. Like, what are the odds of that? I mean, obviously, it's just a coincidence when you look back at it. But it's that kind of paranoia that is rampant in the film as it goes. Mm-hmm. It's like, if so-and-so's in on it, who else could be in on it? And I think it's a movie that a move that a lot of political thrillers nowadays fall into is that, like, every single person is in on it in some way, shape, or form because you wouldn't expect it. The best friend is too. Oh my gosh. Almost to the point where it's like, it doesn't make any sense anymore when they start to do that. But, and this one it does because it just gives you a little bit of a tinge of like who's on the level, who's not on the level. But yeah, it's crazy because she really does bring out who he really is.
Yeah.
And he's not allowed to be that person.
Yeah, that's tough stuff because he to see him, it's almost jarring to see him happy and smiling and enjoying himself after this whole kind of film thus far of him being sort of zombified and brainwashed. And it makes it does so much. It shows that and it gives the audience this a little bit of heart for him. And then it also just solidifies what an awful human being his mom is, that she squashes like this only chance at love that he ever had. And I was also, I thought the misdirection was pretty brilliant with her dressed as the Queen of Diamonds. I thought for sure that she was in on it when she walked in wearing that.
Right. Yeah. That I think is a brilliant move. And then the whole thing too, of like the dialogue that they're programmed to say whenever anybody asks them about Raymond Shaw is, Raymond Shaw is the kindest, bravest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever met in my life, which is the exact opposite of Raymond Shaw.
Yeah.
And the fact that multiple characters do voice this in almost like a program, it just reminds you of that SNL sketch for the, I don't know if you remember this thing where John Lovitz is a hypnotist and everybody, they ask all the audience members and he's like, it was great. It was better than Cats. Like they all say the same thing over and over because he's hypnotizing to give him good reviews. Like, it just reminds me of that so much.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I wish John Lovitz had been in this film. That would have been fantastic too. How old is he in 1962? My brother worked with him actually.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, my brother was an AD for a while and went through the DGA trainee program for ADs and worked on City Slickers 2 with John Lovitz.
Oh, nice.
And he was a good guy, apparently. I won't say who was not a good guy, but you can take a guess.
I could guess.
Of what big star in that movie was not a good guy.
I may have dealt with that person as well at some point. So,
well, we'll have to swap stories off air.
You bet.
Yeah, I thought that the double murder scene was really well executed. For some reason, I think I didn't think he was going to go through with it. I thought that that was the point in the movie where he would break through and just mentally sort of defeat the brainwashing. But it ended up being pretty shocking when he killed him, and then even more so when he killed her.
Yeah, it's messed up. I mean, it's the fact that like it just shows you the power that they had over him is like his own brain can't break it. Like it takes Sinatra's deck of all queens.
Yeah.
And that's actually a real stroke of mercy and wonderfulness that Sinatra says, like, do you forget that this ever happened? Like he keeps that out of his brain.
Yeah.
That he killed Jocelyn and the senator.
Like, yeah, I love that part.
Which I thought was pretty great.
Yeah, because, you know, his character is the major is he becomes kind of obsessed with this, but no one believes him. He's sort of being gaslighted and he's on his own. It's not like they ever really rally behind him until, I guess, the point where he picks out the bad guys from the virtual lineup.
Right.
Is the only time he's sort of taken seriously about this, but he's still not given, like, the plan at the end. It made me so mad was here's my phone. Here's a phone number. Just call this if you feel like you're getting into trouble or something.
Right.
And the whole time I'm like, man, why isn't someone tailing this guy who packs up a gun and goes, dresses up like a priest? Like it would be so easy. And then I was sort of annoyed by that. But then Frank Sinatra's character owns that dumb decision in the movie and talks about what a dumb thing it was. And I was like, oh, okay, well that kind of made up for everything.
And one thing I do like about the fact that like nobody believes him or supports Sinatra really a lot, they don't dwell on that. They don't make it a thing. So many things in these political thrillers, it's just a lot of like, why won't you believe me? I'm going crazy. And then just constantly running around. I just fucking hate that. Yeah. Like it's a trope I don't love of like the protagonist that is right, but everybody else thinks it's crazy. And they have to go through the machinations of it over and over of the fact that nobody supports him and believes him.
Yeah, and I think part of the key to that is having someone like Frank Sinatra in that role because, you know, it's Frank. He's cool and collected. He's not going to do that. If they asked him to, he wouldn't do that on screen. And it doesn't surprise me that he had a lot to do with sort of how this came together as a star and having that kind of influence in the direction.
Yeah, I mean, he really is the perfect part, the perfect role. I mean, he was the one, I think at first they were thinking that he would do the Lawrence Harvey part. And
oh, interesting.
He was, he's like, no, I want to do the sergeant role, which I think is way better. Anyways, I have a hard time picturing him in the Lawrence Harvey role.
Yeah, that would be tough. I did not see the remake and I'm, you know, as remakes go, generally, I'm not the biggest fan of remaking classic films, but I don't think I remembered until I looked it up that it was Jonathan Demme, who I love and have so much respect for. So I'm intrigued. Did you see it?
I did. It's not bad. It's not necessary. It's one of those things where it's like, why remake a perfect movie? But it's not bad. I mean, the pedigree of people in it, Meryl Streep mm-hmm. is in the Lansbury role, Denzel Washington, perfect. And, you know, Liev Schreiber is the Lawrence Harvey part. Like, it's not bad. It's well done. I've only seen it once in the theater when it came out because I have such a reverence for this other movie.
Yeah.
So I might revisit it one of these days just because it's been, you know, 16 years since it came out.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's not bad. They got the right people to do it.
Yeah, I think I might check it out. I did look at the trailer because I just wasn't super familiar with it when it came out. But it looks like that they have sort of morphed the senator character into the son. Is that right?
I think so. I don't remember the exact things that they changed, but
it looks like Liev Schreiber is the politician.
I think it might be, yeah.
And still has this controlling, manipulative mother. And Meryl Streep, I'm sure she's great in it. Like, all the actors they got are fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, she's fantastic. I mean, obviously, like, it doesn't have the same punch as Lansbury did because I know what's coming the entire time.
Right, right.
But, yeah, but she's great. I mean, it's not bad. As far as remakes go, it's a solid remake.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Jonathan Demme, I think, was a very undersung filmmaker in a lot of ways.
For sure. Yeah, he's great.
Oh, look, I think I found the quote.
Oh, nice.
So here it is right here. I shall force someone to take the body away from him, and Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America, even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers to hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy.
That's right.
That sounds familiar.
Yep, that sure does.
I'm glad I found that, because when that happened, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this was made in 1962. And she's talking about rallying a nation of television viewers to hysteria. Yeah, man. It's way ahead of its time, I think, in a lot of ways, philosophically, with its politics.
Oh, 100%. It's creepy as hell. It's so weird that it's the same and yet different now. Another thing, too, like I forgot to mention, is that Angela Lansbury was only 3 years older than Laurence Harvey and had to play around.
Really?
Yep. Which is tough. But if you watch the movie, you don't really question it. It doesn't seem apparent.
She's one of those people who was sort of locked in at when she was 30, she looked 50. And when she was 70, she looked 50.
Right. Exactly. She's just always looked the same.
Yeah. She even had the same haircut. She was good. I didn't watch Murder, She Wrote, believe it or not. I'm like the only human on the planet that never saw that show.
Oh, it's pretty good.
No, I've heard it's great. I think Josh still loves it. He watches reruns. He thinks it's a pretty good, like, comfort food show.
There's a Criterion version of Manchurian, which I have, and there's some pretty good supplements on there. And one is, it does have an interview with Angela Lansbury where she talks about it and how Frankenheimer fought to have her in the movie, and how cool. He was a joy to work with for everybody, because everybody just kind of trusted him because he mm-hmm. knew what he was doing. There's also a thing on there where there's from, because they re-released it in 1988. So it disappeared from public view all these years. Sinatra bought the rights back and yanked it. There's a bunch of like differing versions of it. One is that mm-hmm. he did that out of respect to Kennedy and the assassination, because that's a big, that's the main thing in this movie, is like assassination of candidates, which is, you know, why at the end it's kind of a great ending in a sense that he redeems himself in a little way. But so it was politically controversial in that sense. So he, out of respect to Kennedy, who's their very good friends, he just didn't want, even though he loved the movie and he thought it was great, he just didn't think it should be seen. It just felt not right. So he yanked it until they re-released it in 1988. Now, differing versions say that, like, no, that's not true. It aired on some cable television stuff for the next couple of years. That the reason it got pulled was something to do with rights clearances or something. But that doesn't feel like a good narrative to me. So I'm going to go with he pulled it for his buddy. But then when they released it in 88, it was kind of a success again. It found a whole new generation of viewers. It resonated with like college kids, I guess. And there's a supplement on the Criterion of Frankenheimer, George Axelrod, and Frank Sinatra talking about it then. And like a brief little roundtable of the three of those guys, which is pretty fascinating to look back.
Now, where was this in Frankenheimer's career? Was this one of his first films?
It was pretty early, yeah. He had done a couple movies before it, but not many. This is sort of like the renaissance of Frankenheimer or the next. Like, he just ran off a string of like four or five movies that are his best, right then. Uh-huh. And it started with this one, really. I'll Fall Down was right before it, even though they're shot around the same time, but I'll Fall Down just came out first based on production issues. So like he did this, and then it was followed by 7 Days in May, which is another great political thriller, and The Train and Seconds. And it's, yeah, he just, Birdman of Alcatraz, I think, was right before this or after this as well.
Yeah, man, I don't know why I haven't seen many Frankenheimer pictures. This is going to be a lot of fun. What else you got for Manchurian Candidate?
Let's see.
Got anything in your notes?
There is the sequence of the bartender actually triggering the thing, which I think is so cool and so funny.
That was great.
Because it's like, why wouldn't that necessarily happen?
Yeah, just play solitaire and you're in big trouble.
Right. So, like, he gets triggered and then by the bartender saying, like, yeah, why don't you pass time and play some solitaire or whatever. And so he immediately sits down at the bar, which is always creepy, too, like in the flashback sequence where it just shows him without cards in his hands.
Yeah.
Just, like, putting him down.
Yeah.
And the fact that he gets triggered at the bar immediately, and he says, give me a deck of cards. And the guy gives him the cards. And then he continues his conversation. He says, like, yeah, why don't you just go to Central Park and jump in the lake? And he immediately gets in a cab, goes to Central Park, jumps in the lake. And it just happens that Sinatra shows up right before he goes and does that. And so he sort of figures out that something is amiss here more than he.
Yeah, that was a cool sequence. Yeah. Sinatra's, what are you doing? Get out of there, man.
Right. So good.
Yeah. And shot at Bethesda Fountain and the boathouse there, right? So, you know, so many classic movie scenes have been shot right there. And they, clearly emptied that area out because there's not another human in frame.
Right. It's just crazy.
It's good stuff. It's cool to see New York in 62 as well. Just some great shots of the street and kind of what's like real life going on.
It is good stuff. Fun to watch movies that take place in cities that you know and love from different time capsule. We just watched, Jenny had never seen it, so we watched it time after time, the Jack the Ripper H.G. Wells.
Oh, yeah, with
Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, man, that was one of my HBO movies as a kid. I watched that a dozen times.
Me too, but it takes place in San Francisco, which obviously I spent a lot of time in, and there's a little chase sequence in the Embarcadero, and this was filmed in 79, and the Embarcadero looks exactly the same. Like, it's
does it really?
Crazy. It's always fun to look back on that stuff.
Man, I'd love to see that again. I don't know how you were as a kid, but when I first got HBO, it was just like my life opened up.
Oh yeah.
Between that and MTV. And I would just watch, movies that I'm looking back now, it's really funny that a 12-year-old was watched the movie Ragtime like 5 times and movies like Time After Time. I'd like to go back and revisit that one though. That was a good one.
It's good. It holds up, I think, mostly. But it's good. But definitely, HBO raised me. I always say that. Cause it's
totally,
it formed so much of my movies that my dad was into movies too. And he really loved Manchurian. I think he was the one who introduced me to it.
Oh, cool.
And I used to have the re-release poster hanging up in my bedroom amongst other things. And, and then I had it actually framed at some point. And then in college I had it up on the walls, and now I think my brother has it and it's up in his, place someplace. So,
oh, nice. Yeah, that's cool. It's a movie that I think, I don't know what the reaction was like in 1962, but I imagine it was people didn't quite know what to make of it back then.
I think it did pretty well. Obviously, it was critically acclaimed. It's not one of those movies that was panned and then later Oprah's like, oh, wait, it's actually good. Because it did get – it got the 2 Oscar noms, which, should have had more. Angela Lansbury, by the way, lost to Patty Duke in The Miracle Worker. I won't begrudge that one. Because at the time you look back on these classic performances and you see who beat them and you're like, really? Okay.
Yeah. I could see Frank maybe getting a supporting actor nod just because he was such a big movie star.
Yeah. But it wasn't nominated for Best Picture, which I think is kind of criminal. But, at least it's one of those things that, like, time has served it well. It was acclaimed then and it's acclaimed now.
Yeah. And it feels like a movie, too, that some movies that are made back then are such a part of the current zeitgeist that they just, it's not that they don't age well. They're just sort of locked in time. But a movie like this, it's like a good, it's like reading Catcher in the Rye every 15 years or so. It's like got new relevance as you get older and politics change and things people come and go, but the messages here are eerily relevant today. You know, Russia and China and puppet candidates, and it's really good stuff.
It is pretty crazy. And I mean, like, one of the reasons I don't really like politics is I feel like it's very divisive, and I don't like things that don't bring people.
You think?
I prefer things that bring people together. I prefer things that, yeah, like, hey, we love this movie, so let's talk about it. And other people can be like, yeah, I love the movie too. Like, I much prefer that versus like, hey, here's my opinion on something. Well, yeah, I have the opposite opinion. And instead of respecting your opinion, I'm going to yell at you about your opinion. And then,
yeah, it's the worst.
Yeah, it's the worst thing. It's almost, it, you know, it's almost like somebody, like, if you want to pop culture, it's like when, you know, Last Jedi came out or something, and the camps that you had on that, instead of people just being, you know, happy that there was another Star Wars movie.
That was me.
Let's just shit all over it or defend it to the end of time. I don't know. I just prefer things that, that bring people together.
Yeah. When it comes to the Star Wars stuff, I am, you know, raised on Star Wars, loved that stuff when I was a kid. And now when I see those movies, I just go in and I'm like, yeah, man, this is great. Another cool Star Wars movie. I don't read too much into it. None of them are the best movies ever made. They're Star Wars movies, and I like almost all of them.
That's like a point my dad made when I was growing up, when they were still making a ton of Star Trek movies. He's like, some are going to be good, some are going to be bad, but it's just another episode of Star Trek.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, that's 100% true. And he used to joke that the next Star Trek would be Sulu's birthday, Star Trek 8, Sulu's birthday or whatever. That was a joke. But but yeah, like, to me, that's what it is. It's another episode and something you like. And yeah, ultimately, it doesn't – what I don't – the argument I always make is like, okay, you didn't like it or whatever. It doesn't tarnish or diminish the movies you do like.
Yeah, totally.
They're not taking those movies and burning them, being like, well, we can't have both, so right, you can no longer see The New Hope ever. Like, to me, that's the problem with that kind of thing. And like, the reason I actually don't mind remakes half the time is it brings attention to the original film, and often they clean it up and they put it out in a special edition in Blu-ray or like make it widescreen, like whatever. That's the one reason that like I'm okay with the remakes, is it brings more people to the original.
Yeah. And I think I remember that happening when the remake of this one came out. Yeah, I'm going to check out that remake. I'm down.
Cool, cool, cool. Yeah, I should probably rewatch that too.
So what's next on our list?
Well, we have The Train. We have Seconds. What was the fourth one I chose? Oh, and Ronin.
Should we go in order?
Sure. I think The Train would be the next chronologically.
All right. I haven't seen it, so that'll be another great experience for me.
Cool, cool, cool. It's either The Train or it's Seconds. Definitely not Ronin. Ronin's last.
Yes. I did see Ronin once, but again, just once.
Yeah. Great movie.
All right, Cole. Well, thanks for coming in, and I'm glad we're turning people on to the work of John Frankenheimer. I think he is a pretty undersung director as well. Great body of work, but you know, even a movie guy like me is kind of unfamiliar with a lot of it. So good choice.
Thanks. Thanks. I hope people actually like the stuff and go check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. There were some big Manchurian Candidate fans when I posted that this was coming. So,
oh, cool.
I think this will go over pretty well.
Awesome. Love it.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, man.
All right. We'll see you guys next week. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.